Hello and welcome back to the Bentley Priory Museum podcast. My name is Alexander and I'm here as your host for this episode. This podcast has been established alongside a temporary and now permanent exhibition called Bentley Priory's Bunker, Defending Britain from Nazi and Nuclear Threat. This project wouldn't have been possible without the funding given to the museum by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. In this episode, we will be exploring the progression over time of how women have become integrated into the Royal Air Force, including oral histories from some of the members who worked down in the bunker at RAF Bentley Priory. We are now joined by podcast volunteer Tim, who will give us some more background about these changes before hearing from the women who experienced it themselves.
Women first supported Britain's Air Arm in 1917. When they were recruited to serve the Royal Flying Corps and Royal Naval Air Service in ground-based roles such as drivers and dispatch riders. The Women's Royal Air Force came into existence on the same day as the Royal Air Force, 1st of April 1918. At any one time during World War I, 25,000 women served in a wide range of ground-based, non-combatant roles, including wireless mechanics and operators, photographers, carpenters and riggers. In the search for economies after World War I, the Women's Royal Air Force was disbanded in 1920. With another war on the horizon, women were again called into service in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, or WAF, created in June 1938. Again, they served in non-combatant ground branches and trades. A key technological innovation at the time was radio direction finding, or RDF, more commonly known as radar. In this context, as part of the Dowding System of Integrated Air Defences, WAFs made a significant contribution as special duties clerks in roles such as radar operators and plotters. Many special duties clerks served in Fighter Command Headquarters at RAF Bentley Priory, where the operations room, originally in the Priory itself, moved into an underground bunker during the war. Mary Hulse was posted to Bentley Priory in 1943. Typing reports for the intelligence officer in an office in the bunker. Mary recently spoke about her time there as part of the museum's oral history project.
A very, very interesting job, because you used to get down below was the plotters and then the balcony, and so they all used to come in the office, the officers getting with their reports from, you know, various ones, the intelligence officer and all the different ones, and they used to come in from the balcony and anything on. I mean, some nights there wasn't anything on, but other nights and days we were frantically busy. Well, I've worked shifts like the ops girls did, but I was not an ops girl. And they didn't like, it was actually, it was very unkind. There was just one of us on at a time, watch at a time. And I don't know how the others, because you never actually saw them, you just exchanged. They were anxious to finish their assignment. We were anxious to get, well, I was anxious, what was coming on. But when it came to break time for a coffee and things, we never knew whether to go to the ops canteen or to the teleprinter's canteen. Well, if you went to the teleprinter's canteen, being on your own, I was thinking about it this afternoon, they were very unkind. They used to sort of say, oh, she's slumming it today. And if you went to the ops one, they said, oh, you know, they used to. So we were sort of in between, that we hadn't got a place, really. I didn't realise how interesting it was, because the officer you worked for, there was the intelligence officer and the reporting officer. And the reporting officer used to be on the balcony watching all the activities and writing it down. Then they brought it in to whoever was on, the typist was on, which when I was on, and you had to type up the reports for that. And then you also had to type up the reports of what the intelligence officer got, so you worked for the two of them. When I first went into this little office, there was another, there was a clerk, a fellow, an RAF fellow, and also somebody else, but gradually just they got rid of them and just had the officer and the typist in the office, that's all. Used to go up these very steep steps to go up to the canteen when you had to go up for a coffee or anything. And on the steps, you met all sorts of famous people coming down. They used to spend, come if there was going, there was a special raid on or anything, quite often. I mean, the king came down while I was on duty. He no doubt came down a lot of times, but, and various, you know, famous people used to be going up the steps to go and get your coffee, and they'd be coming down the steps. And he came down to see what was happening because they were watching all the plots on the table, the raids and things. And they came down the king. I mean, he used to get all the high ups on around the table. That was the idea of the thing. I mean, we didn't mix with them, but you could go and see them. I mean, today somebody would tell you, the king was down tonight or so-and-so, because we were too busy. There was only one of us on at a time. There were two originally. There was a clerk as well. But I don't know why they disposed of the clerk and they just had the typist on. But, because there were hundreds of typists working during the day, but this was just a watch thing down in the ops room, down in the room off the ops room. Office who you were working for would perhaps, if he was one of the nice ones, he'd come and tell you so-and-so's on the balcony tonight, or actors, you know, famous actors and things like that. They used to come down, and if we had time, we used to go and have a peer at them.
Though non-combatant, WAFs made direct contributions to combat operations, for example, guiding defending night fighters onto enemy aircraft. They faced the same threats as their male colleagues when their bases came under attack by the enemy. 187 WAFs were killed and over 400 injured during the Second World War. WAFs were awarded 2 George Crosses, 6 military medals, and 3 British Empire medals for their gallantry. Some WAFs used their radio skills in volunteering for duty on special operations in enemy-occupied Europe, supporting resistance groups as wireless operators. The women's services continued after the Second World War and throughout the Cold War, reclaiming their original title as the Women's Royal Air Force in 1949. Though still non-combatant, for a short time in the 1950s, women were allowed to become pilots as part of the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve. Social restrictions and mores of the time meant that it was 1960 before married women were allowed to serve, though they were still automatically discharged if they became pregnant. Jan Bridget served in the Women's Royal Air Force in the late 1960s, and when I spoke to her as part of the museum's oral history project, I was curious to hear her perspective and whether it felt like the Women's Royal Air Force and the Royal Air Force were two separate services. This was her answer.
No. I mean, I'm assuming that they got paid more. I might be wrong. I don't know. Without doing some research, I don't know. But we all did the same job. The only things that the men did that we didn't do was when we were abroad, was they learned how to use rifles. And at that point in time, we couldn't, if we could have done, I would have done, to be honest. That was the only, and they went to places abroad where we wouldn't have been posted, like when they were under tents and things like that. But the men did virtually the same jobs. My recollection, we did almost identical jobs. Yeah. Even going up the ranks, you know, apart from the fact that there weren't many WAFs, that there weren't many of us, so let's say on every watch, I think there was a rule you had to have two women on every watch. You couldn't have one woman on a watch, there's been two. But apart from this, so you were always outnumbered by the men. But I honestly, I can't remember. Now, whether it's me just forgetting on purpose, I don't know, but I can't remember any distinction made between the men and the women, you know, either in promotion or in jobs or in the way that you were treated. You know, we were treated the same way. I might be forgetting it, but I don't recall much sexism. I can't. The only thing I think when I was at Bordsey, when you had to climb down, you were very aware if you try and maybe remember to put trousers on rather than skirts, because if someone was down there, they could see up your skirts. But that didn't happen at Bentley Priory. I honestly, and I might be totally wrong here, but I can't remember much sexism. And of course, when I was playing hockey, I was playing mixed hockey as well as single sex hockey. And, you know, you were, no, I really and truly put my hand on my heart. I can't recall any racism. I can't recall any bullying. I can't recall any sexism. Classism, now, there was very much, because of the officers and the ordinary ranks, there really was a distinction with that. They did get preferential treatment. You know, they were in the officers' mess and they had batmen and batwomen. They were looked after. There was a big distinction between the officers and the ordinary ranks. But like I said, you could, if you were able to, rise up through the ranks, corporal, sergeant, flight sergeant, warrant officer, and if you wanted to, you could become an officer. So there was even, you know, there was progression. Yes, there was a division there, and I was very aware of it, but you could progress. You could, and I'm my hand's on my heart when I'm saying that. I really, really can't think of any examples of sexism or racism. I feel, if my memory's serving me right, we were all treated equally.
The Women's Royal Air Force gained combatant status in 1984. At first, women aircrew were only allowed to fly non-combatant aircraft. But this changed, and in 1994, the first female fast jet pilot joined a frontline unit, the famous 617 Squadron, then flying the Tornado. In the same year, the Women's Royal Air Force ceased to exist when it merged with the Royal Air Force, and females finally became subject to the same pay and regulations as males. Wing Commander Erica Ferguson was one of the new generation. She trained as an air traffic controller, having joined the Cambridge University Air Squadron as a student in 1989. Erica rejoined the Royal Air Force in part-time reserve service as a wing commander. She is now head of heritage for the Royal Air Force and additionally a trustee of Bentley Priory Museum. It's appropriate to give Erica the last word.
I joined the University Air Squadron without really thinking about it and was lucky enough to be selected. But once I joined the University Air Squadron, I loved the opportunities for sport, for adventure. I found that I loved aeroplanes and flying. And most of all, I loved the people, being with a bunch of like-minded people working as a team was just the best thing ever. I joined as an air traffic controller. I was sponsored for my last year of university and then went to Cranwell to do my officer training, then to Shawbury to do my air traffic training, and then had a number of tours in the Air Force in London and in Scotland, finishing up in High Wycombe as a squadron leader. And by that time, I'd had two children, and it was very difficult to stay committed to an Air Force where I had to travel a lot and might have had to go away for up to 6 months. So I decided to leave the Air Force then in 2006. But it was a very exciting and fruitful career. I wouldn't change any of it. More recently, I've come back into the Air Force in a part-time reservist's job as a wing commander, and my current job is head of heritage for the Royal Air Force. So I look after museums, I look after old aeroplanes and stories, silver and art for the Royal Air Force, and work with other aviation museums to share Royal Air Force stories.
As ever, I hope you have enjoyed listening to this episode and learnt more about the inspirational people who worked at RAF Bentley Priory. As mentioned at the start of this episode, we now have a permanent exhibition open supporting this project outside of the museum's top secret bunker, as well as the ongoing temporary exhibition until December this year. We will be back again with one final episode to wrap up this oral histories project, defending Britain from Nazi and nuclear threat. So until next time, take care and thank you for listening.